If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. I'm Ed Newcomer. This is Nature Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. Today, our guest is Corky Roberts, joining us from his home in Arizona. Corky is a former U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Special Agent, but before he became an agent for the Fish and Wildlife Service, he did many years as a wildlife officer for the state of Washington. And then after becoming an agent, he worked in places like Arizona and Alaska, and then later in Washington. He was a pilot agent for us for many years and served as a resident agent in charge in Alaska. He finished his career out in an area known as Tri-Cities, Washington, which he'll talk about in a little bit. But one of the great things about Corky is he's a former SEER instructor for the U.S. Air Force, which stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, I think. And he actually used to teach at the Fish and Wildlife Service Agent Academy. He did a segment on survival, if any of our agents ever got into trouble. It's one of the more memorable aspects of my academy experience, which we'll talk about a little bit. Corky, thanks so much for being with us. I really appreciate you joining us and being on the podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me, Ed. I've been looking forward to this.
Me too, honestly, in part because of the story we're going to talk about today, but also in part because I always enjoyed working with you when we were agents together, and you always had such a positive attitude about everything, and anytime I worked with you, put me in a good mood.
I can say the same. I always enjoyed our meetings, except when you were doing your arm bending and that kind of thing. You get a little intense on that sometimes.
That's true. That's right. Corky and I were both in the same region for a while. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service law enforcement is divided up into geographical regions. And for a while, we were both in what was then known as Region 1, which was basically the West Coast. And I was a defensive tactics instructor, so I got to help agents learn how to land on the ground safely and bend each other's arms in funny directions, right?
You always liked ground fighting. That was the part I know Ed was always excited about.
Well, I have to say, you know, I know for sure that what we got as agents at the academy as far as, you know, surviving in remote situations or survival situations was nothing like what you taught as a SEER instructor to U.S. Air Force pilots. But I do have to say that the training you gave at the academy class that I was in was very memorable. And although, you know, it was abbreviated only, I think, of maybe a few days, I really left your training feeling so confident that if something happened to me out in a remote area, I at least had a chance to get myself out of it. I still remember some of the lessons you taught us during that course, and you were a great instructor as far as that goes. You left us feeling like, okay, at least we have a chance to make it out of this alive if something happens to us. So that was great.
Most like anything, just get to where you're thinking about it. You know, that's part of the battle right there.
So. Exactly. So listen, what we're going to talk about today is a really interesting case, and we have about an hour to talk about it, so I want to get right to it. But at the last part of your career, you were based in a single agent station in kind of south central Washington, an area known as Tri-Cities. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about where is Tri-Cities, what are the Tri-Cities, and what's it like there?
Well, the Tri-Cities are three cities: Richland, Kennewick, and Pasco, Washington. And they're all right near the confluence of the Columbia and the Snake River, where the Snake River runs into the Columbia River. One part of Washington that people are familiar with is Walla Walla. And Tri-Cities is about 40 miles west of Walla Walla and about 120 miles south of Spokane, Washington. And it's in the you might call it the desert area of Washington. It's near the Hanford Nuclear Project, where they developed the plutonium that made the first atomic bombs during World War II. It's really a beautiful area, and with the Columbia and the Snake River there, it's a lot of wildlife resources in the area.
Yeah, so typically, what does a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service special agent work on when they're assigned to that duty station in Tri-Cities?
Well, I was the first officer there in quite some time. They opened the duty station there. When it was previously open, it was a waterfowl post. I mean, waterfowl hunting was a huge sport in that area because they had a lot of refuges in the area, and then there was a lot of grain and flooded areas, and so there was a lot of waterfowl. But with the with Oregon there, with the rest of eastern Washington was basically wide open. There was no agent in Spokane for the first couple of years I was in Tri-Cities. And so I covered everything from the Canadian border down to the Oregon border and sometimes down into Oregon. Lacey Act, Migratory Bird Treaty Act, there was 2-3 Indian reservations in there that had some, significant wildlife resources that people were concerned about. And so it was a busy, busy post.
Yeah. You know, that whole topic of the Native American reservations is could be a whole episode in and of itself, because of course, Fish and Wildlife Service is under Interior, and Interior has a trust relationship with all of the recognized tribes in the United States. So, anytime, there's wildlife crime involving, it taking place on a Native American reservation, it's pretty common for Fish and Wildlife Service agents to get involved and help the tribal police and deal with those issues, as well as, help with conflicts with the states and things like that.
There was some of those, but I did. I spent a significant amount of time on the Yakima and the Colville Indian reservations. Yeah.
Were wolves making their way into Washington yet at that time, or was that a little early?
No, that was when I first got there. Not yet, but they showed up. They were there. It's just they appeared in investigative subject matter the following year after this one case we're going to talk about.
Okay.
And yeah, that was kind of the first wolf case in the state of Washington.
Oh, interesting.
That was in 2008. Yeah.
And you worked on one of the first wolf cases, Em?
Yep.
Interesting. Yeah. Wolves, of course, it's a complicated issue, but even though they're delisted in some states, Wyoming, I think Montana, Idaho, if they move out of those states, down here in California, there's a number of wolf packs, but they're still protected by the Endangered Species Act because they're outside of that delisted zone, which I think was the case there in Eastern Washington at that time.
Washington, they were out. They became outside the zone, but initially they were inside the protected zone. And just to kind of go off on a tangent a little bit, this first case, these wolves came out of Canada.
So they naturally
immigrated. So.
Yeah, which happens. And once they mm-hmm. cross the border, of course, they come under the protection of the Endangered Species Act.
That's correct.
But we could get enough on the side.
Yeah,
on wolves.
Yeah, we could go on.
One of the things that I know you and I have in common is we like to work, we like to be in the office during the holidays, and I used to like to work at night because it's quiet, nobody's there, you can actually get reports done, and you can get things done when that you can't get done easily when there's a lot of people around or stories to tell or chit chat to do. Mm-hmm. So I know around 2007, you were taking advantage of everybody being out of the office. You were in your office by yourself working on reports just before Christmas 2007. And you got a call. Tell us about this call you got.
It was actually after Christmas, 2 days after Christmas. Okay. And I had the office to myself. I mean, and I was in a refuge office at that time. So there's, 20 or 30 people there usually, but I had it to myself. And like you said, you can get a lot done.
Right.
But at this time, I just happened to be there kind of kicking back, I guess, not even really working on anything. And the phone rings and you know, I picked it up, Fish and Wildlife Law Enforcement, and the guy and the gentleman identified himself as Special Agent Jack McLean with Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Spokane.
Okay.
Jack said, well, he said, you know, I have a question for you. And he said, can you bring a monkey into the United States?
I got to stop you right there because that is a loaded question to get right after the holidays, right?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I kind of said, well, I said, probably not. Most likely not in the context that you're telling me. And why don't you tell me the story?
Yeah, of course. The next thing is, okay, what do you got, right?
Yeah. And he said he got a call from a young lady who was working at the Fashion Bug store, which is a clothing store in Spokane, Washington. And she said she was working as kind of the screener or greeter or whatever you call it, that where they come in the front door. Right. A day or two before, it might have been 2 or 3 days. I can't remember the exact date, but a couple was carrying what appeared to be a baby, and they went to the back and they were talking to one of the employees back there. And all of a sudden she hears this squeaking noise. And she said, it didn't really sound like a baby, but it piqued her interest. Right. And, so she goes back and they have a small primate monkey.
Oh boy.
Wearing a diaper, and they're holding it, talking to this employee about it. And she overheard them saying that, well, we brought it in from Thailand and that was illegal, but now that it's here, it's legal. And, you know, obviously they had read something incorrectly. So she became quite alarmed about it. And, without going into too big of details, apparently she called local police, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, the FBI in Washington, D.C., who actually referred her to Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Spokane. So she was determined to get to the bottom of this. And maybe I can tell you why later, but I didn't find it until after the case was over why she was so inspired.
There's two aspects to this. One is, first of all, she was persistent, right? Like, she didn't know who to call, so she starts with the police, then probably the police referred her to the state wildlife agency. I assume she got, you know, a kind of a ho-hum response because she kept, they obviously didn't help her. But, you know, I think this is actually a testament to the fact that you were dialed in with some of these other agencies. And it illustrates the very important point that fish and wildlife agents, especially when they're working in remote areas or in single agent stations, they have to be connected with other law enforcement agencies, because the public often does not know that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service even exists as a law enforcement agency. They don't know who to call. So if you're not connected in with Homeland Security or FBI or other agencies, nobody will know to call you, right? So thank goodness you were connected in with Homeland Security, Immigration, Customs Enforcement, so they knew to call you. But tell you told me before, but this tipster had seen a movie recently, right? And that's why she was concerned. What was that movie? Yeah. I forget the title.
After the case was over, I contacted her and we visited for a while. She said she had rented the movie Outbreak,
the
night before this happened. Yeah, the one with Dustin Hoffman, and they had to bomb the town or something because of the disease outbreak. She went to Blockbuster Video, which some of your listeners may not know what Blockbuster Video is, but she rented the movie Outbreak.
Well, and that movie is basically about a disease that gets into, a very infectious disease that gets into the human population that originates in primates, actually.
Correct.
Which there are diseases like that, such as Ebola. So then my next question to you is, you know, why is smuggling? Well, first of all, there's so many interesting things about this. Like, I love the fact that the people in the store just willingly tell a store clerk that it was illegal to bring it from Thailand. But now, of course, now it's legal. It's amazing what people will say out in public. But from your perspective as a fish and wildlife agent, there's multiple. I know there's going to be multiple reasons for this, but why is smuggling a monkey or bringing a monkey into the United States a crime of concern for a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agent?
Well, first off, they're protected under the, they're listed as under CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, as Appendix 2. And there has to be a permitting process in order to get them into the country. Monkeys are also dangerous animals, or primates are. And many states now have laws prohibiting possession, ownership, sale, transfer, or whatever, of primates. And part of the reason for that is they do carry some very serious diseases. And plus, they're mean. They really are. And when this case got going, we found some fascinating emails that these people received about from renowned or well-known primate or monkey breeders who said, why do you have a rhesus macaque? One of the emails in particular said, this will kill your daughter.
Interesting.
This monkey will kill her. Yeah. And I mean, they were really upset about it. And so they're dangerous animals. And, there's only certain reasons that you can bring one into the country. And that's for educational purposes, like a zoo, or for, research.
Yeah.
Like medical research.
Right. And monkeys have been in the news recently about regarding another U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service case called Operation Longtail Liberation. And that particular case involved an investigation into the illegal importation of primates for the medical research trade. And what you're dealing with is very different here. This is an individual who's bringing in a monkey, presumably as a pet, right? Rather than as a...
Right.
Yeah, which in many ways makes it more dangerous than the primates who are smuggled in for medical research, because those primates at least are isolated away from the public. In this situation, you've got this person traipsing around Spokane, Washington with this live primate that maybe just weeks before had been living in a foreign country exposed to who knows what.
Primates
can, primates can carry all kinds of diseases that can be transmitted to humans, including, tuberculosis, Ebola, of course, is the big one. You name it, because they are primates and we're primates, there are many diseases that co-infect all of both species.
Correct.
So tell me about, now you've got this detail from this Homeland Security special agent. What do you do next? What's the next plan?
We talked and decided we kind of put together an initial investigative plan, because he was in Spokane. So he was right there where this event happened and presumably where the monkey was.
Right.
I was in Tri-Cities, 100 miles away or so. And so we agreed that Jack would try to run down and identify who these people were.
Okay.
My job was going to be reach out to the U.S. Attorney's Office, because it was more likely going to be a fish and wildlife case.
Right.
So set up that, figure out what we're going to do with this monkey when we get it.
Right.
And, and then try to figure out how we're going to deal with it. Not just what we're going to do with it. How are we going to, we're going to euthanize it, or we're going to keep it alive, or what? And so that was going to be my role in this initially, until we got these people identified.
Okay.
The other reason I asked Jack to do this is because him being in the Immigration and Customs Enforcement or Homeland Security, he would have access to a lot of databases that we did not, like National Crime Information Center. I didn't have a terminal in that refuge office, as well as some other local and statewide intel databases where might be a little easier to identify these suspects.
Yeah. Homeland Security has, because of their connection with U.S. immigration, they have access to incredible databases about basically who comes and goes from the United States, right?
They can kind of, that was a big one.
Yeah, they can kind of backtrack and figure out who arrived in the U.S. at a particular date and even a particular time. So that's a very valuable partner to have in an investigation like this, for sure.
Huge. I mean, I've tried to do that on my own as a fish and wildlife agent. You have to go through the subpoena process, and it's a nightmare.
Yeah. No.
Whereas immigration, they've got it right there in front of them. And that was just a huge help to this case. So that's where this started. Is I was going to die at a part, Jack had a part.
And what, when you reached out to the U.S. Attorney's Office, what was their reaction to this case?
Well, the first person I talked to was a guy with environmental crime section in Maine Justice. And Bob, and he's, rest his soul, but he and I had worked on things before. And when I called Bob about it, I said, told him the case, and I said, what do I do with this monkey? Right. And he was like, his comment was, I don't care if you put it in the freezer, but it doesn't need to be out in the public. That was one answer.
Right.
Then I reached out to the Spokane, the Eastern District of Washington, and I talked to the intake officer there, and they assigned it to a U.S. attorney named Stephanie Van Marder, who is just a blessing. And she consulted with the chief criminal deputy, and they said, this thing needs to stay alive because federal rules of criminal procedure require that you preserve evidence intact.
Oh, interesting.
If at all possible. And so they said, we got to keep this thing alive. And, poor Stephanie, she caught a lot of grief over having a monkey smuggling case. She came into her office and the thing was decorated with stuffed monkeys.
This is a good place to talk about two things. One is, in my experience over the years, there are times when you do have to destroy animals. For example, when they're invasive species come into the United States, those animals are often humanely euthanized and destroyed. But, in my experience, if you can, it's important to try to save the animals that you end up confiscating for, just being a good person aspect of it. You want these animals to live. But also, there's a headline element to this too, right? The public doesn't want these animals killed, and so if you can avoid it, it's good. I had not ever considered the whole federal rules of criminal procedure, though, or the evidentiary rules about maintaining the evidence in its current state. That's really interesting. But we often do keep animals, alive. Sometimes we have to care for them, but. Usually zoos or some other facility will care for them while we're waiting to go to trial. That's interesting. The other thing is, you pointed out that this assistant U.S. attorney got a lot of, fun-loving grief about it from her office mates. But I remember hearing about this case as when it came up. I was based in Los Angeles at this time. And our first reaction, all of the agents in L.A. who prided themselves on, we work on international trafficking cases, we were like, what's Corky Roberts doing with a monkey smuggling case up in Washington? We were so surprised. And, it's not the usual kind of case you deal with in a smaller area like that, especially not. There's no international airport there that necessarily goes to and from Spokane, like down in LA where we see a lot of, or to and from Thailand, down in LA, we see a lot of people coming and going from Southeast Asia. It was just funny because it's like, what's a monkey case going on? Why is there a monkey smuggling case going on in Washington?
I think once Stephanie got her teeth into it, she's like, I'm not giving this one up. She said, I've caught enough grief on this. And I think she actually enjoyed it after a while, but it was a challenge for her. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure she did. Okay, so now, rather than working with a Department of Justice lawyer out of D.C., you're working with a local assistant U.S. attorney at the U.S. Attorney's Office there in Spokane. She's getting ribbed by her colleagues, but she's on board. What happened next? Did you figure out who this person was? How did you figure out who this person was that went into the story?
We did. I mean, I think the first thing is, we did. Jack... He went and interviewed people at this fashion bug store, And they were very hesitant, but you know, I think once he convinced them that this is a federal matter, they started to open up a little bit. And he, just a very short order, he got the suspects identified in the Spokane area.
Okay.
And Gypsy Lawson and James Pratt were the couple that came into the store.
Okay.
That day. And
do you know how he figured out it was Gypsy Lawson and her boyfriend Jack?
It was a phone number. He got a phone number and ran that through this database, and it came back to this James Pratt. And I think eventually then he, if I remember correctly, one of the clerks at the stores knew that it was Gypsy Lawson.
Gotcha.
And then he started doing the homework and running the immigration databases and things, and figured out that Gypsy had traveled to Thailand first part of November. And then Jack identified Gypsy's mom as going with her, or Gypsy going with her mother to Thailand.
Right.
And they went there the first part of November and came back right around the end of November. They left from Spokane, went to Korea, then to Thailand, and they came back through L.A. and then rented a car and drove to Spokane.
Strange. That is interesting.
Why did that happen? Yeah.
Why not fly up from L.A. to Spokane?
All right.
And I have to tell you another, as soon as we found out, so here we are, the agents in Los Angeles. So first thing we find out is Corky Roberts is working on a monkey smuggling case in Washington. That's unusual. And then we find out his suspect came through L.A. and we didn't catch her. You know, that was, we were watching this case with great interest, Corky. I got to tell you, down in our office. Okay, so now you've got Gypsy Lawson and her mom identified as having traveled to Thailand. Now what? What do you do next?
Well, we had to figure out what to do. We knew we were working on a warrant to find out, once we figured out where this monkey was. And so we found Gypsy's residence, and then we identified Fran's residence, which Fran Ogren was her mother, up in Northport, Washington, kind of in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, where's the monkey? Is it in Northport or is it in Colville? So we were working on warrants for both of them. But, you know, in the meantime, we still had to figure out what to do with this thing.
Right.
Because I had contacted the Centers for Disease Control to find out, what are we dealing with?
Right. Because that's one thing. Unlike a lot of law enforcement officers, fish and wildlife agents, a lot of our evidence is alive and it needs to be fed, and it could be dangerous for a lot of reasons. And that's not something that most law enforcement officers have to deal with, is live evidence.
No, that's true. And you can't just put it in a shelf, you know, in a locker room.
And you've got not only public safety issues now because it's a primate, but you've got safety issues for you and all of the other law enforcement officers who are going to work with you on a potential warrant. When you're talking about a warrant, you're trying to get probable cause, develop probable cause to get search warrants, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what did you learn? You called CDC. What was their reaction to this call?
This was a very interesting conversation. I called up and I got a hold of a, you know, communicable disease specialist, and I can't remember her name now, of course, but I explained the situation to her, and she said, how long has this primate been in the country? And I said, 4 weeks, maybe 4 to 5 weeks.
Right.
She said, okay, that rules out filoviruses. And I'm like, okay, you have to speak English. I don't know what you're talking about. She said, well, like Ebola, you know what that is? I said, yeah, I've heard of that. Right. And I said, so how do you know it rules out filoviruses? And she said, well, because there'd be dead people everywhere by now.
Oh, my God. That must have sent a shiver down your spine, right?
I said, now you have my attention. You know, and so I said, okay, so now that we can breathe that sigh of relief, you know, what else? And she went through a litany of things. And, you know, the two that stick with me was tuberculosis was one. And then the herpes viruses, which, you know, crossing the human boundary can lead to encephalitis and, you know, all kinds of horrible things. So, you know, we were worried. We didn't know if we were going to have to talk to everybody on the plane, you know, how are we going to deal with this? And so we weren't real sure. And so got that figured out. And then we said, what? Okay, so we're talking about doing search warrants to seize a live primate. And we have to be prepared for things that we're not normally prepared for when we go do search warrants. You know, search warrants, you're always, okay, bad guys and edge weapons and firearms and, you know, that kind of thing. Right. You know, drugs, fentanyl exposure. This is like, do we go in with Tyvek suits on? Do we, you know, how do we deal with this? Right. And then when we get it, what do we do with it?
Yeah.
You know, do we carry it out and put it in the pickup? You know, no.
Put it in a dog carrier, or what do you do with it?
Yeah. You know, and so I called vets, I called the zoos, I called a number of places. You know, could you keep this thing? Nobody wanted it. Seattle, nobody wanted it. And
interesting.
Somebody, I think CDC finally referred me to the primate quarantine facility at the University of California at Davis. And I talked to them. And got a hold of them, and they said, yeah, we can help you out. We can do this for a fee, of course. And this brought in a whole new level of bureaucracy and bureaucratic involvement, which we can go into or not.
Oh, yeah, we got to go into it because this is part of what it takes.
How do I get it there? Yeah, how do I get it there? How do I get this thing to you? You know, I can't put it in my pickup. I can't put it on Alaska Airlines jet. I mean, And she said, give this guy a call.
Okay.
And so I called up this number, and the guy answered the phone, Duncan, with Furry Freighters.
Furry Freighters.
Furry Freighters. And I'm like, okay. You could tell he was driving down the road. You know, you could hear the wind noise in the background. I said, okay, Furry Freighters, do you transport primates? Uh-huh. That's all I do.
That's all he does.
I said, you have a job to transport primates. He said, yes. And I said, well, I got a story for you.
Yeah, let me tell you a story.
Told him a story. And, you know, I said, sometime here in the next couple of weeks, we're going to need you to pick up a primate in Spokane, Washington. He said, give me a few days notice and call me with an address and I will be there.
Wow.
With a trailer that's equipped to transport quarantined or non-quarantined primates.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was stunned. First of all, I couldn't believe somebody actually has a job transporting unquarantined primates, but
exactly.
He does.
Exactly. Yeah. But also, whew, what a relief, right?
Oh yeah. It was until I tried to get permission to spend the money to do it. And
So that's a whole nother topic about, you know, sometimes for the most part during my career, we had excellent supervisory agents, you know, who understood what it took to do the job. But every once in a while, that was not the case. And I, you know, I've talked to more than a few agents, and I know during the latter part of my career, I spent as much time trying to outthink and outmaneuver the regional special agent in charge as I did bad guys, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was frustrating. But
absolutely.
I assume at some point you explained, and usually what got the attention of senior management was when you explained to them the alternative, right? And the alternative is you're going to have a really bad headline on your hands if you don't pony up the money to help me safely move this primate.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume that's what happened here, right? You explained the alternative consequences.
That and I explained to them that they were going to have to call the U.S. Attorney's Office and explain to them that. And they're like, oh, we can't. I guess so. You know, maybe we can have a bake sale or something, and we can keep the money, or we can make the money to do this with a bake sale or something. You know, I'm just making that up. But
that's sometimes that's how they acted. But you know, when you think about, you know, you've got the animal care issue first, but you also have the public safety issue. It's not money should never be an issue on that one. You have to do it. So, okay, so that's relief. You've got a plan now for how you're going to deal with this primate. And, you know, I think this is a good opportunity to point something out. This was 2007, 2008-ish, right?
2008, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at that time, the way that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agents across the country and wildlife inspectors dealt with live wildlife that they had confiscated, it was very grassroots, ad hoc. It really came down to who you knew, right? So in L.A., we had really good relationships with the San Diego Zoo, the L.A. Zoo, different, you know, AZA-approved animal care facilities. And it really came down to I happen to have those phone numbers in my phone. And if I seized a live animal, I knew who to call and say, hey, can you do me a favor, basically? Can you hang on to this animal maybe for weeks, maybe for months while we process the case? Now, thanks to an agent you and I both know named Aaron Dean, who was later the resident agent in charge in Los Angeles, toward the end of her career, she kind of pioneered this live wildlife confiscation network. And she coordinated with the AZA, I always forget what AZA stands for, but it's the accreditation organization for zoos. She coordinated with them so that there is now in place a system, a process for how zoos are committed now to helping U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and other agencies house and deal with confiscated live wildlife. But so now at least there's a system. So a brand new agent who doesn't have contacts, there's a way for them to access this live wildlife confiscation network and find a home for their animal without a whole lot of work on their part. But back prior to this, thank you, Aaron Dean. But prior to this, yeah. at the time you're dealing with this primate, none of that existed. And you, Corky Roberts, in addition to doing your investigation of this crime, had to find a home for this primate. And it's hard to articulate how much work that is and how stressful it is.
That was tough. That really was tough.
Very stressful. Okay, so now you got it worked out. How did the probable cause develop for your search warrants? Did you?
We had lots of probable cause by this time. Now Jack McLean, the ICE investigator, he actually contacted James Pratt at Gypsy and had them meet him down at the Homeland Security office. And he told them right up front. He says, "I understand you guys have a primate that you brought in."
And I confronted him.
Well, he confronted them right off the bat, and he wanted to interview them separately, and Jimmy wanted to be present during Gypsy's interview, and so he wouldn't let him. So that was pretty much the end of the interview. But during that process, when Jack first reached out to James Pratt, and James told him that, "Oh, no, this is all a misunderstanding. We actually bought this monkey in Southern California from a known breeder."
Well, they've admitted they have the monkey, right? Perfect.
Yeah, and they also have a false. Now we have a false statement too. We eventually came up with one.
False and statement, so and that's the classic Martha Stewart crime. If you lie to a federal agent, that's a felony.
Yep, it is.
Okay,
and it's a great tool. And great tool. So we wrote up search warrants for both Gypsy's house in Spokane. And her mom's and dad's house, or stepdad's house, up in Northport, Washington.
Okay.
So we had to do simultaneous search warrants on these two places because by this time they knew we were looking for this monkey. Okay. Yeah. So
that thing could disappear easy.
Yeah, they could have turned it loose. They could have done a lot of things, but we were fortunate that it did not happen. But we thought maybe they don't know we know about mom up in Spokane or up in Northport.
Right.
And so maybe it's up there. And so we ended up getting warrants for both places.
Perfect. Perfect. So when you do this warrant, you had talked earlier about, holy cow, what do? Do we wear a Tyvek suit? What did you decide? How did you decide to handle the safety issues?
That was a very different. It was an interesting part, you know, because we always do the search warrant briefings with our teams. And so we had Homeland Security. We had Fish and Wildlife, you know, basically the entire you know, Washington and Idaho contingent were there for this thing, as well as state officers.
Okay.
And so we had this briefing and talked about the issues that we were dealing with. And I remember one of the Homeland Security agents said, "This is the first time in my career that I'm ever going into a search warrant with a shotgun loaded with bird shot."
and the purpose of that was what?
We weren't sure. You know, we weren't know if this thing was going to be hanging from a curtain and attack, or start scratching and clawing and biting. You know, we just weren't sure what kind of a hazard we were dealing with.
But right.
That's always stuck with me. You know, going into a search warrant with birdshot. But
yeah, because there could be a crazed monkey running around the house.
But,
you just didn't know. It's no joke. I mean, even though macaques are fairly small, I think their canine teeth are 2 inches plus long. They're very dirty. Their hands and their feet are extremely dirty. They often have their own urine and feces on their hands and feet. So even a fingernail scratch from a primate like a macaque could be deadly. It could introduce a really infectious disease into whoever got scratched. So yeah, I don't blame you for taking a shotgun with bird shot in it, just in case you have to shoot in a wild attacking.
I don't either.
So, what about the Tyvek suits? How'd you handle your potential exposure to airborne?
We did have masks.
Okay.
We had like booties on and that kind of thing, you know. But we didn't do the whole Tyvek suit thing. It just a little bit too much. Yeah, you got weapons and all kinds of things you got to have. And it just seemed a little bit too complicated.
Too complicated.
To try to do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We were hoping that we didn't have to worry that this was an oversight that we weren't going to regret. So not an oversight, but
I mean, everything you do in law enforcement is a risk, and it's a calculated risk, and you try to minimize risk, but there's always risk, right? So you have to make some decisions. And now you've got a multi-agency team. You have U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agents. You've got Homeland Security or ICE agents, plus uniformed state wildlife officers from the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. You're going to hit both houses at the same time, I assume, right? So that evidence doesn't disappear.
Okay.
So that's another difficult thing, is to coordinate teams that have to execute warrants at the same time. That's a lot of people coordination.
It was. And it was difficult because in Northport, where the team that I was on at Fran's house, their cell coverage is very spotty. But we made it happen. It worked out. And it got it.
So
we all hit the place at the same time, and we had no problem getting in. I mean, they came to the door up in Northport, and we're not happy to see us, but they were cooperative and not combative or anything like that. I mean, they were an elderly couple.
That's the North Fork's the mom's house, right?
That was mom's house. Okay. And the house in Spokane, they had a little more of a complication there because it had like a big screen metal door on it. And knocked on the door, and Gypsy would not come to the door. She would not answer the door. And finally they got a hold of Jimmy, who was working or out somewhere, and he called her and said, "You need to open the door right now." And so she finally let him in.
Yeah. I mean, the next step is you're going to forcibly open the door.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So which warrant were you on? Were you up North Fork at the mom's house or down?
I was in North Fork at the mom's house. Correct.
Okay.
And Steve Furr was the team leader on the one in Spokane.
Okay. Yeah. Steve was a guest of ours 2 weeks ago. So that's awesome. Okay. So tell me about that. What happened? You go in, what do you see up on your warrant there in the north part?
In the north part, we actually sat down with Fran, and she said, "The monkey is not here."
Okay.
Okay. So, but we cleared the house and, did whatever we're supposed to do. And like I said, they were pretty cooperative. We ended up seizing a significant amount of records from Fran. She was a pretty notorious diary keeper. She kept a pretty detailed diary of their whole trip, as well as a computer with pictures and emails and all kinds of things on it. So it was a treasure trove of evidence in this case. Excellent. She lawyered up. She said, she finally said, I think I probably need to consult with an attorney. We respected her wishes.
Yep. That's one of those constitutional things. If somebody is kind of in a custodial environment and they request an attorney, all questioning stops. No question, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
What happened down at the Spokane warrant?
Spokane warrant, like I said, they had a hard time getting in the door, and they finally did. And they went through the house the first one or two times. No monkey. Couldn't find it.
That's kind of a no shit moment.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we've all been there, in some way or another. But they finally, Steve, I think he sat down with Gypsy and said, "Where is it?" And it was in the dog's kennel.
It was there.
In the kennel crate with the dog. And
right there in plain view.
Right there in plain view. And I remember Steve told the story that he's sitting there in the bedroom and he's like, "What in the world? What are we going to do?" And the bottom drawer of the dresser comes out on its own. It opens. Ooh. And a skunk gets out.
A skunk
crawls out of the dresser and goes over in the corner of the house and pees, and then goes back and gets in the dresser drawer. And he said he was like, "This is surreal. This can't be happening." But then about that time, they found the monkey. It was in the thing, and the guys from Furry Freighters came in, grabbed the monkey, signed the chain of custody information. They had a trailer. They had all kinds of food and everything in there for it, and off they went.
Perfect execution. Yeah. I mean, I'd never heard the skunk part before, but heck, if you wrote a screenplay that had that in it, nobody would believe it. That is an awesome story, actually. That's even better than a lot of the monkey part. I can just see Steve's face, too, as a skunk comes out, the corner, goes back in his drawer. So down at the Spokane warrant, I assume Steve's team did some interviews as well. What'd they get out of the...
I think same thing. They pretty much, I think everybody pretty well lawyered up by that time.
But you recovered a lot of documents, you said. What did you learn from these documents about... How did Gypsy and her mom do this? What was the plan? What was the scheme? How did it all happen? How'd they get this primate into the U.S.?
So the whole plan started. I guess Gypsy and her mother were quite estranged for a while.
Okay.
And Fran was a freelance author, and she got a contract or an offer from like Western Horseman magazine to go to Thailand and do an article on an elephant training facility.
Okay.
And so sometime in the interim between when this contract was funded, Western Horseman magazine or whatever magazine it was, I think that was, it went out of business. So she was pretty disappointed. So Carl, her husband, said, "I'll pay your way, take Gypsy with you, and y'all have a great time." So they went. They went over there. And from what I remember from the trial and from everything, I don't think there was ever any plan to get a monkey until they got there.
Oh, okay.
And when they got there, Gypsy fell in love with monkeys. And it became, and Fran even wrote this in her diary, "This has become a monkey quest to find a monkey." And so they began a quest to, find Gypsy a pet monkey. And then, through the emails and the diary that we, eventually read and seized, and, and actually the email account from Gmail that we got, we learned that they went to a monkey training facility. They contacted monkey breeders who were advertising monkeys for sale, and one guy in Cameroon. Whoa. And they reached out to him while they were in Bangkok to see if he could send them a monkey in Bangkok, from Cameroon. And they were going all in. And so they ended up getting a hold of a guy named Boris from the Thai horse farm. Uh-huh. how they found him, I don't recall exactly, but they got a hold of Boris and they said they wanted to find the monkey. And so Boris went on a mission. One of the comical stories that came out in the email or the diary was they went to a town called Chiang Mai, which is known for free-ranging monkeys everywhere.
Yep, that's in the northern part of Thailand, yep.
Right, and they got there and they checked into a hotel and there were howler monkeys all over. I think there were howler monkeys all over the place. And so one was walking by the sliding door. And Fran wrote that Gypsy reached out, grabbed a baby monkey off that one's back, slammed the door. An entire troop of howler monkeys came up and started beating on the door. While in the meantime, this little baby monkey is running roughshod around this room. You know, this is a circus. I mean, I'm reading this story and I'm just howling, laughing.
Yeah.
I can't believe it's happening.
Also infuriating because super dangerous to do that. That female mother monkey could have really hurt Gypsy.
Oh, yeah.
But also cruel. That's cruel as you can be.
It is as cruel as you can be.
Unbelievable.
And so they finally couldn't catch this thing. And so they opened the door and it ran out into the hallway of the hotel and ran down the hallway and the maids were scattering everywhere and everything settled down finally. But around the 24th or 25th of November, they received an email from Boris that he thinks he'd found them a monkey.
Okay.
And so they went to some remote village with him. And I actually think this village may have been in Burma, but I couldn't ever, or Myanmar. I couldn't ever prove that part, but it seemed like it. It looked like there were border crossings that they were waiting at.
Interesting.
And they went to a village and there was pictures of this small rhesus macaque inside of the cage. And next pictures you see is Gypsy's got it in this car and they're driving away.
Do you know how much they paid for it?
I don't know. I never did find out. Never heard. I don't know if they paid anything or they gifted them, they traded something. I don't know.
I did some work in Thailand as an agent around 2010. I spent about 6 months there doing some work as an agent. And I was shocked at how easy it is to buy exotic wild animals pretty much throughout Thailand. In fact, in many cities, people will approach you on the street with, slow lorises, different wild animals, and just offer to sell them to you right there on the spot. It's not good.
No.
So it doesn't surprise me that she, it actually surprises me that it was as difficult as it was for her to find somebody to sell her a baby monkey.
Yeah.
But, okay. So now she's got it in Thailand with her. How the heck does she get it back to the States?
Apparently they took a bus from wherever they obtained this monkey or from the Thai horse farm back to Bangkok.
Okay.
And they sedated the monkey with sleeping pills, and Xanax, and God knows what else they had. And they got to Bangkok and now they're in a quandary.
Yeah.
We have a 26-hour flight or 24-hour flight.
Yep.
So we have to keep this thing sedated. And they actually found a veterinarian to give them sedatives.
Wow.
To give this baby monkey while they transported it.
Wow.
And
this raises all kinds of other issues. You're going to sit on an airplane with 400, 300 other people in an international, flight, like you said, 17, 24 hours inside the passenger cabin with an animal that could be carrying infectious diseases. I mean, the negligence of the Gypsy on this is phenomenal. The risk to the public is huge. And, it just highlights the importance of, counter wildlife trafficking law enforcement efforts, not just to save animals, but to protect the public from exposure to zoonotic diseases like this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm thinking as a smuggler, all right, do I stick it in a handbag? How do I get it? You got to pass through security. You got to pass through U.S. customs, through Thai customs, Thai security, which is very tight. They have strong security at their airports. I would think I'm going to get caught with this monkey in a handbag or a backpack. How the heck did they get it through security and on the Thai side? And how in the world did they get it through U.S. customs and passed? our crack wildlife inspectors in Los Angeles. How did they do it?
They had a pouch, and they made it look like Gypsy was pregnant.
Oh, my God. They strapped something to the front of her, under her clothes, and made it look like she was pregnant.
Yeah, made it look like she was pregnant. And that was quite revealing when we saw the pictures. It was like, because we didn't know at this point.
Yeah.
And you see pictures from when they first got to Thailand, and here's this relatively slim young lady posing in front of, you know, the exotic trees and flowers in Thailand.
Right.
And then, you know, 3 weeks later, she's obviously, you know, 8 months pregnant.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And well, there's pictures of her in the Thailand airport, standing in front of a gate at I can't remember the name of the airport in Thailand or in Bangkok, but obviously very pregnant and
unbelievable. And then, so she smuggled this animal on her body, basically
on her body. Correct.
Which I mean, you just think about the consequences if that sedatives that she was given the monkey could have killed it, but it also might not have worked. And can you imagine this monkey waking up in the middle of a flight? Talk about the snakes on a plane situation. This is a little crazy.
Yeah. All of a sudden take off running down the aisle. Oh, God. Yeah.
Swinging from the, you know, the overhead, right? So that's incredible. And, you know, just the idea that she passed through U.S. Customs at LAX, passed through Thai Customs, it's no wonder they decided to rent that car and drive it up to Washington, because they were probably sweating bricks by that time, and the monkey had been sedated for 24 hours plus, so crazy.
Yeah, and apparently they had some extra sedatives, so they kept shooting it. When it would start to stir, they'd give it some more. You know, it's a wonder they didn't kill it.
Yeah, it's a wonder they didn't kill it or give it brain damage or something like that.
You know? Oh, they did. So they did that.
It did cause brain damage.
It does cause some tremors. So the monkey has, I don't know if it's still alive either, but you know, it did have tremors for several years after that.
Now what? You know, you've got all this information. Did you arrest them?
No. We didn't.
Okay, but did they get charged?
They did get charged. They got indicted, and then there was a superseding indictment, you know, several months later.
Okay.
But no, they were never arrested.
What'd you charge them with?
Initially, they were charged with smuggling, conspiracy to smuggle, Lacey Act, and the false statement. And then, but the superseding indictment was trimmed down to basically smuggling, conspiracy to smuggle, and the false statement.
Those are all serious.
Every crime
you just mentioned, including the Lacey Act, those are all felonies.
Yes.
And then the minimum on those is 5 years, $250,000 fine. I mean, that'd be the maximum penalty, but that's the lowest of those. Smuggling's 20 years.
I think it's 20 years.
Yeah it's 20 for inbound smuggling. It's 20. So those are some serious crimes that they were charged with. What'd they do? Did they plead guilty or they go to trial?
They did not. They went to trial.
You got to love that.
And they do. And, you know, all three had public defenders.
Okay.
Now, Jimmy Pratt, he agreed to plead guilty to a misdemeanor.
Okay. And he didn't go to Thailand. He was only involved kind of after the fact, right?
But he was still charged with conspiracy and smuggling itself, because he concealed, you know, the after the fact. And
right.
And so he was still charged with smuggling, but he pled guilty to, I think it was the Lacey Act, if I'm not mistaken, right? I'm drawing a blank here right now.
That's
but
all right.
He pled guilty to a misdemeanor in exchange for testifying against Gypsy and Fran.
Oh, wow. He turned on him.
He did.
Okay.
He did.
So they actually went all the way for a jury trial, though, Fran and
they went Gypsy? All the way. Yeah, yeah.
And what happened there?
You know, you asked me a couple of weeks ago about their defense, and they really didn't have one. There was no defense, but I really think that the lawyers were free, of course, in a public defender.
Yeah.
And I think that Fran was hoping for jury nullification.
Okay.
I think that she was hoping that they would see the ridiculousness of this whole thing and a jury would nullify it. Or, and she also, I think she wanted to write a story. She wanted to expose the big, bad federal government taking on these poor people who were just trying to take care of a primate. And, you know, it didn't work. But and it didn't. I mean, she actually petitioned all the way through the Supreme Court.
Oh, no kidding.
It got denied. It got denied. Her petition.
I take it they were both convicted after their jury trial.
They were both convicted.
And then they went through the appeal process and tried.
They went
unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. Do you remember what they were sentenced to?
They were sentenced. They both got 60 days and $4,200 in restitution or something like that. It was minimal. And I don't know that either one of them ever served a day. Gypsy passed away several months after the trial, and I think it was an automobile accident. Fran, she continued to fight this all the way through the Supreme Court. And I remember her attorney, her public defender, when he first, I think this was one of his first cases that he took on. And so he was kind of a true believer there for a while. But he called me after about 3 years and he says, She wants her stuff back. Would you just give it to her? Her documents. There was like some documents, some receipts from, you know, an elephant farm or something in Bangkok, you know, that we just grabbed a whole bunch of stuff. Right. Yeah, I'll be glad to. He just says, just make her go away. I just want.
You know, so talking about the sentences, the way, unfortunately, there's something called the U.S. sentencing guidelines, federal sentencing guidelines, and they're not mandatory. They're advisory for judges to follow. But they, I don't know if you know this, Corky, but they have not been updated. Basically, in the sentencing guidelines, you can look up by crime kind of where a person falls, and it gives a range, just so listeners understand. But the sentencing guidelines related to wildlife crimes have not been updated for 40 years. Yeah, and they're very badly outdated. They have not been adjusted to reflect the increase in wildlife trafficking and crime. And so a lot of times these people don't get jail time because of the way the sentencing guidelines play out for them, even after they go to a jury trial and they're convicted.
Right.
The plus side is, and I think it's important to remember, is first, when it comes to the sentencing, they were convicted of felonies. And once that's on your record, that has a dramatic impact on your life to have a felony conviction. There's lots of things. Sometimes it can be difficult to get certain types of jobs. Certainly, if you commit other crimes in the future, having had a felony conviction will almost guarantee that you go to jail for future crimes, including future wildlife crimes. So it does have a deterrent impact. So I hope you don't feel... You know, I hope at the time you didn't, and now you don't feel that it wasn't worth it, because I see this case as very important. And even though they didn't do jail time, it's still a good sentence because they
it
did.
Is.
They
no,
did
get it the was. It's I've had worse, believe me.
True.
I mean, I've had just the opposite. I had a guy get 3 days in jail for a duck stamp one time. But
yeah,
right. That was in Fairbanks, Alaska, in a different circumstance. But that was interesting. But it was an important case. I mean, this made worldwide press. I mean, it was all over. It was around, and you know, hopefully, some people looked at it who went to Thailand and elsewhere in Korea and places where you could buy wildlife on the street, and they realized, oh, that's beautiful. Maybe I'll just take a picture and take it home with me. You know, which I used to tell people that. I said, take a picture of it.
Yep.
You know. If you buy something that's made out of, you know, pangolin shells or whatever, you're going to look at it and it's going to sit there and, you know, then nothing, you know. But take a picture of it. You got the picture forever.
Yeah. And, you know, that's another important thing, is it deters people from doing this. And the real insidious thing about what Gypsy and her mom did, they weren't bringing this monkey in to sell it. It's not part like they were part of a trafficking scheme. But... walking around with a monkey on their shoulder in Spokane, wherever, taking pictures of it, putting on social media, that actually encourages other people who never would have thought about it before. They might say, oh, that's so cute. I want one. And now the Lawsons, Gypsy and her mom, are creating a demand for monkeys. You know what I mean? So that's why this case, as even though it's a one-off, this is the one time they did it. There's no evidence they were going to do it again or sell the monkey. Still critically important to deter future bad behavior by other people who, you know, but for meeting the Lawsons or seeing their social media posts, never would have considered buying a monkey. You just don't want the demand to get started. And so good to nip this in the bud. I love this case. I love that. This is one of my favorite all-time cases that I knew of when I was an agent. Yeah. I love it.
There's so many nuances, too, that really just...
Yes, totally. And, you know, everybody's going to want to know, Corky, what happened to the monkey?
Well, the monkey ended up getting through quarantine. It did have these, they did not have any communicable diseases or anything like that.
Good.
It did have tremors. So it developed some shakiness. And we ended up finding a place in Vancouver, Washington, and it was a primate rescue facility that basically rescued primates. And it was a nice lady who had a soft spot for primates. She willingly took this on, and without charging us anything, even though I still feel guilty about that we never gave her, you know, a few grand to, you know, raise this monkey. And to be honest with you, I mean, that was 2008, 2009. By that time, I have no idea where Apu, that was the monkey's name. I have no idea if they're still in business or if whatever happened to this thing. But she checked with me a few times after that, you know, once a year or so, and just told me how Apu was doing. And, but yeah, he was ill. He was not well from probably just from being sedated.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But at least he had a safe, place at a permitted facility that knew how to care for him and would do it safely. Right. So that's a good ending for Apu, as far as I'm concerned, because there's no way you can take him back to the wild. So
no.
That's awesome. Corky, what I'm going to try to do is, just for our listeners, if they're interested in more information about this case, I'm going to try to post some of the documents from the court proceedings on the website. I'll put it on NatureSecretService.com. If anybody's interested, you can go to the website, look for this episode, and you'll get some access to other documents, and maybe I'll get you to send me some photos and stuff.
Did I send you the email to the witches group?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll put some of those.
I was going to mention that and I forgot about it, but that was one of my favorites.
we're running out of time now, but I meant to ask you about the whole witches group. But yeah, there's a witch element to this whole case. But maybe we'll just have that as a teaser. I'll try to put some of those information up there on the website. But Corky, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show to tell this story. You're a great storyteller. This is an excellent case. I'm so happy that you got a taste of the international trafficking there in the Tri-Cities, Spokane area. And, I appreciate you being with us. I know you're headed off now soon for the fire season. You fly airplanes to suppress fires in Texas and around the country. But be careful out there. It's fire season. It's getting more and more dangerous to fly these planes. But I appreciate you doing that. And I hope you have a safe fire suppression season this year. But thank you so much for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, Ed, thank you for inviting me. And I wish you the best of luck in this endeavor. I think it's going to be a great success for you. Well, for us, too. I mean, this is important to get this information out.
Fantastic, Corky. Thanks. I'd love to have you on another episode in the future.
I look forward to it. Maybe we can talk about wolves.
That sounds perfect. All right, my friend. All right, that'll do it for this episode of Nature Secret Service. I want to thank Corky Roberts, our guest, for telling us that fantastic story and joining us today. Always a pleasure. We'll see you next time. Nature Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at NatureSecretService.com.